Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Alex Golub, a professor of anthropology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and the host of the channel today. So today we're going to be talking to Sophie Chow, who is the Discovery Early Career Researcher Award Fellow and lecturer in anthropology at the University of Sydney. And she is the author of the new book, In the Shadow of the Palms, More Than Human Becomings in West Papua. So Sophie Chow, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Alex. It's wonderful to be in conversation with you.
So can you tell me a little bit about your early training and work? And I think you said you wanted to begin with land acknowledgement because of your situation in Sydney. Can you tell me a little bit about the land where you're currently situated? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about your early training and work.
Sure, Alex. So I'm speaking to you today from the unceded lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation here in Australia. And I'd like to start by paying my respects to Gadigal elders, past, present and emergent, and also pay tribute to Gadigal kin, both human, animal, vegetal and elemental. So I'm an environmental anthropologist and multi-species ethnographer by training. And over the last decade, I've been interested in the intersections of ecology, capitalism, health, and justice in the Pacific region. I came to develop this interest through my prior career in the human rights sector when I was working for an international human rights organization based in the UK and in Indonesia. And that brought me to conduct investigative research across the Indonesian archipelago and particularly in the Indonesian-controlled province of West Papua, where I then ended up doing my PhD and postdoctoral fieldwork over a period of 18 to 20 months. And a lot of this research really centers on Indigenous peoples' experiences of large-scale land-based transformations, particularly industrial oil palm expansion, all within the bigger context of anthropogenic climate change and the sort of ecological unravelings that are key markers of this current epoch.
So you got your start doing activism. And as some listeners of the podcast would know, West Papua is the western half of the island of New Guinea. The eastern half is the independent state of Papua New Guinea. And this is an area that's undergone a process of colonization or settlement by Indonesia. And that includes both some settler colonialism as well as the creation of large plantations. And there are many West Papuan activists and other people who have called this a genocide. So it's a very, very fraught situation. So you started as an activist, and then that led to some intellectual interest as well.
Absolutely. So the region of West Papua has been under settler colonial rule since the 1960s. And my initial engagement with communities on the ground was in the capacity of an advocate supporting ongoing grassroots land rights struggles and advocacy in support of Indigenous customary land rights and often in the face of large-scale extractive top-down development projects, including mining, pulp and paper plantations, and more recently, oil palm plantation development. governments. Eventually, I shifted my angle to a more anthropological lens, largely in light of the fact that a lot of the activism I was engaged in demanded a sort of simplification or reduction of the incredibly complex and messy realities that I was witnessing in the field in the interests of effective advocacy and in the face of corporate and state actors. But there was so much more going on in the everyday lived lives of these communities who are being displaced, dispossessed, and disempowered under both colonial and capitalist regimes. So the idea behind the long-term fieldwork was really to try to get a better insight and understanding of how everyday life plays out, and particularly the sort of culturally shaped ways in which oil palms' arrival in customary Papuan lands is reconfiguring Papuans' relationships, not just to each other, but also to the settler colonial state, to settler populations, and to a whole array of different introduced and often invasive non-human species, including oil palm itself.
Mm. So where did you go to do your PhD, and who were some of your sort of intellectual mentors of influences that helped you turn that initial sense of complexity and that awareness of the richness of those issues into an academic study where you're doing field work and you have a set of theoretical questions you're trying to answer in addition to the importance of documenting the particularity of this case?
That's a great question. So my undergrad master's training in anthropology was in the UK at Oxford. I then went on to work for the Forest Peoples Programme, an Indigenous organisation that works across the tropics. And then I decided to come to Australia to undertake my PhD, in part because of the geographical proximity to Indonesia, in part because had I not been able to do my fieldwork in Papua, I was able to work with diasporic exiled Papuan refugee communities, but also because I had found a number of different mentors who were each going to bring something different to the project methodologically and conceptually. And so I had the privilege of working with three different supervisors, Jaap Timmer, who's an anthropologist of Melanesia, working primarily on state formation and political anthropology. I was supervised by Eve Vincent, who's an anthropologist of Aboriginal Australia and has worked on environmental justice movements led by Indigenous Australian communities. And then I also benefited from the supervision of Eben Kirksey, who's a pioneer in the interdisciplinary field of multi-species studies, a current that is really trying to resituate the human within a broader spectrum of consequential life and life forms, including plants and animals. So my PhD really sort of flourished at the intersections of these three quite different approaches to anthropology and to what engagement and knowledge production in anthropology can or might look like. And I was constantly sort of, strategically bringing in different theoretical and conceptual ideas into the mix through the lens of these three quite different approaches.
Yes. You know, the title of the book is In the Shadow of the Palms. And that S at the end of palms is important because this is sort of the story of two kinds of palm trees, sago and oil palm. And then after the colon, you get the more than human becomings, which I take it to be sort of a reference to that multi-species kind of work that you were interested in.
Absolutely, yes. And it's funny that you mentioned that a shorter extract of this book was published a couple of years earlier in Cultural Anthropology, and that one didn't have an S at the end of palm. And over the course of writing the book, it became increasingly clear that, as you say, this is the story of two very different palm species. The sago palm, which is a native palm of Papua, and one that's also cherished as a kind of kin by the Marind peoples whom I worked with. And then at the opposite end of the sort of moral vegetal spectrum is oil palm, this introduced invasive plant that many Marind describe as a colonizer because it's taking over the lands and ecosystems that they and sago palms require to survive and thrive. And the more than human element of the title, yes, very much speaks to what the book is trying to do, is to sort of think through the multi-species entanglements that are being subverted, severed, but also enabled in different ways by the transformation of biodiverse native forests into industrial or palm monocrops. And, you know, I toyed for a long time between the sort of more than human or multi-species framing. And there were a whole range of reasons why I picked more than human, one of which is that the idiom of species that's sort of embedded in multi-species very much finds its roots in a particular way of understanding the world, namely secular scientific taxonomical frameworks. And I wanted to stay closer to the more than human because it spoke more faithfully, I think, to the ways in which Marin themselves experience and theorize their relations to other than human beings.
Mm. So can you tell me a little bit more about the Marin and who they are, how you did your field work, and how they fit into the argument? Obviously, we have two palm trees. I should have mentioned the people that you were staying with as well. Tell me about the Marin and what the challenges are that they face.
Sure. So I spent 18 months conducting fieldwork amongst Marin living in three settlements located along the upper reaches of the Bian River in the Papuan district of Merauke, which borders with Papua New Guinea. The primary method I was using was participant observation, which entails long-term immersion in the everyday life of my host communities. I also participated in expeditions to the forest, mainly to forage foods. A lot of my fieldwork involved walking across the landscape, bivouacking, listening to people's stories and conversations about the environment surrounding them, and also, of course, documenting the sorts of challenges that these communities are facing in the context of large-scale land appropriation by foreign and domestic corporations for the development of privatized oil palm plantations. So these developments are often being undertaken without the free, prior, or informed consent of local landowners. They tend to be presented as fait accompli, with very little space for communities to voice their own aspirations or to participate in a transparent way in land allocation processes. And all of this, of course, sits within the bigger picture of West Papua's settler colonial history, one in which the region has been under colonization since the 1960s, following a controversial referendum. So the sort of bigger picture of denied sovereignties and denied self-determinations is the bigger context in which land appropriation and indigenous dispossession are happening in Merauke and elsewhere across the region.
So they have a forest that they travel in, which is really important to them, and they're just seeing it being cut down and replaced by apparently just massive plantations of monocrop oil palm, and which is all sort of on a grid and all surrounded with razor wire, barbed wire, and it just sounds like it must be an absolutely massive change for them to experience.
Absolutely. And it's a change that has happened relatively fast. Oil palm was introduced into the region around 2008, coinciding with a spate of large-scale land acquisitions or land grabs across the global south during that period, prompted by the food, fuel, and finance crisis of 2008. And these plantations are indeed massive in scale. They can reach up to 300,000 hectares, and they often lie adjacent the one to another in a sort of patchwork of privatized concessions that are owned, managed, and patrolled by corporate forces, often in collusion with military forces who are employed as plantation personnel. And so we're talking about a highly militarized landscape as well. And indeed, that privatization not only has undermined Marin's access to traditional foodstuff that they would derive from the forest, but it has also radically severed the intimate and ancestral relations that they have traditionally entertained with forest plants and animals, whom they also consider as kin and with whom they share common descent from ancestral creator spirits.
Yeah, you have a chapter in here which describes what it's like for people to make sago. I think that the book opens with an image of water in a container. And that image I've seen on I think a version of it is on the cover. And I think I've seen it in some of the other materials that you use. Can you just tell me about what SAGO means to people, and for readers or listeners who aren't familiar what SAGO is and how it's processed? I found that chapter to be just a very lovely and very human account of what it is like to harvest SAGO and be in the forest and be with other people. It was a very compelling account of how people's lives are made meaningful through their engagement with the place where they are.
Thanks for that, Alex. Yes, so the chapter you're pointing to there, which really hones in on the multisensory fleshly interactions of Marin to SAGO palms, sits somewhere towards the middle of the book, and it, in many ways it offers a welcome moment of pause and a hiatus from the attritive violence of the monocrop regime that is the focus of so many of the other chapters. So it's a bit of a breath of fresh air, if you wish, in which I invite the reader to follow Marin in this practice of going to know SAGO, Pigikanal Sagu, which is a big part of everyday life in Marin communities, and one that entails traveling to SAGO groves, often in groups and for extended periods of time, to process SAGO, to obtain the SAGO starch from the SAGO palm, which the palms are felled, and then the trunks are rasped and leached with water to extract the edible flower. But more than that, it's also a practice of immersion, sensory affective immersion in the environment of the SAGO palm, through practices of listening, of touching, of observing, of tasting, through which Marin really try to come to grips with the multi-sensory, multi-species life world of this venerated and cherished palm that coexists with a myriad different other organisms, insects, mammals, birds, other vegetation, rivers, mangroves, swamps, and so forth. So it's a deeply, sensorially charged space and practice, and it's one that, in contrast perhaps to the shadow, the looming shadow of the monocrop, offers shelter and shade to both human and other human beings who know how to live with and share space with the SAGO palm.
You know, I do my field work in highlands Papua New Guinea, where SAGO doesn't grow. And I've had it only a couple of times when I've been visiting people on the coast. And I've always been struck, it's like a lot of staple starches. It can absorb flavor very easily. And I know people who cook it in lots of different ways, sweet and savory. And there's a one moment in the book where you ask somebody what SAGO tastes like. And as I was reading that passage, I sort of thought, you know, I'm not sure that that's a very good question, because SAGO doesn't taste like anything. It's kind of neutral, and it's kind of tastes like wherever it's from, you know. And then the person who you asked the question to said, it tastes like everything. And I just thought that was such a wonderful moment where they describe it tastes like the animals, it tastes like the birds, it tastes like the forest, you know. It's connected to everything, so it sort of tastes like everything.
Absolutely, yes. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because a lot of the anthropological scholarship on SAGO has, to some extent, been quite denigratory of this particular starch, because it's, you know, low in nutrients and vitamins and proteins and so forth. So it was really fascinating to ask Marin, you know, what were the gustatory valences of this foodstuff? And it turned out it's impossible to actually explain in simple terms what SAGO tastes like, because this flour, this starch, crystallizes in many ways the various flavors and the various life forms that together animate the SAGO grove as a multi-species space. And a central part of that is this idea of skin and wetness, which are two prominent concepts or material semiotic figures in Marin cosmology. Skin and wetness refer to bodily flesh and fluids that are shared by all life forms, and also elements for that matter, rivers and mountains and soils, and that are perpetually being exchanged and transferred and passed on between and across different species and organisms in a life-sustaining and vitality-producing way. And so skin refers to bodily skin, but also to the surface and bark of trees, and the fur and feathers of animals and birds, wetness refers to blood, grease, tears also, but also sap, resins, and all kinds of other life-sustaining fluids. And so food is rendered nourishing and palatable in light of these exchanges of skin and wetness that are perpetually reshaping and nourishing both Marind and their diverse other than human kin.
You say that when people are processing the sago flour, they'll rub the flour on their children's face so that they share skin with the sago, I think you put it. That's just a wonderful, very powerful cultural moment, I thought, just full of meaning.
Yes, absolutely. So yes, people will rub the wet starch of the sago palm pith on their children's bodies to enhance the glossiness or the wetness of their children's own skin and flesh, and to, you know, encourage them to grow strong and healthy. People will also pre-masticate sago and then actually pass on the pre-masticated food to their loved ones as a sort in a sort of direct transfer of their own bodily fluids. People who process, who rasp and leach the sago starch also instill the starch with their own sweat through their labors, which is then taken in by those who consume it. So again, there's this perpetual exchange of fluids happening between and across humans and other than humans. That's a really moving, I suppose, and fleshly way of thinking about relations of eating and being eaten and feeding and being fed across species lines.
I'm sure you're very familiar with this literature, but if listeners aren't familiar, I believe Stephen Feld has recorded songs of people working sago. So if people Google that, they can actually listen to the sounds of Kalulu people as they're processing sago and singing, and the singing is harmonized to the rhythm of them processing the sago. You get the feeling that it's a full body experience, I suppose, as you just said.
Absolutely. And Stephen Feld's work has been super influential on my own thinking, particularly his concept of acoustemology, or knowing through hearing, which I engage with a lot in this and other chapters, because it's so central to the way in which Marind experience being in the grove, right? Through this sort of attunement and attention to the rhythms and harmonies animating this more than human space, and also to the sounds of their own labors, as you describe, the processing, the rasping, the leaching, the felling, the singing, the storying, the joking, and so forth, all of which sort of come together in shaping the bioacoustics of the sago grove.
Yeah, and you know, it's very interesting to me. I think one of the dangers of giving a description of, you know, if I can be so blunt, like darkly complected people in the forest working their subsistence crops at harmony with nature, is that there are certain kinds of tropes of, you know, the noble savage or communal harmony, unity with nature, which have a kind of history which is problematic and are often inaccurate. But you make the point that for Marind people, this kind of connection with the plants and animals that they encounter is one of difference and also one of restraint, that they don't see themselves as merging with these forces, that their connection to these forces come from giving a certain amount of respect and distance to them. And that resonated with me because I've experienced that from my own time in New Guinea. But I think for many listeners, that might sound very strange, how care and restraint can be connected. Can you tell me a little bit about that part of your argument?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's something I certainly struggled with myself in the practice of ethnographic representation, right? Avoiding slipping into the slot of the ecologically noble savage, or portraying indigenous Papuans as sort of organic conservationists. And that's certainly, a troubling and problematic trope. And what came to the fore during the course of my participant observation among Marind and Merauke was this ethos of what I call in the book, what I call restrained care. And this is the idea, it's one that applies not just to Marind's interactions with plants and animals or the landscape, but also with, you know, in child rearing practices. And this idea that care should never be at the expense of the autonomous growth, agency, and affordances of the person that one is in relationship with. So one expression of that, for instance, is Marin's reticence to engage in domestication, either of plants or of animals. And this is because they very much see domestication as a form of control or mastery or domination or indeed violence that deprives plants and animals of their own autonomous capacity to grow and proliferate and eventually die through their own and species-specific ways. And that's also a reason why they don't domesticate animals as pets, for instance, and that they see domesticates as kind of problematic entities because they've lost their autonomy or freedom. And often people will use the term autonomy and freedom interchangeably. And I think a big part of that ethos of restrained care or minimal manipulations of the environment also comes down to an acknowledgement of the unknowability of the non-human world, the idea that one can never fully grasp or comprehend the perceptual life world of a plant or an animal, and respecting that radical alterity, I suppose, is the counterpart to the ethos of egalitarianism that is so much that is so central to the multi-species ethos undergirding Marin's ways of being and knowing, and that not all beings can be known, and that respecting that unknowability is just as important to care as is the attempt to know through the senses and through stories and through lore and so forth.
Yeah, I think it would be difficult for many people to wrap their head around the idea that you shouldn't plant a garden or start a farm because it would be rude to the plants, but that's how they feel, not just about plants, but also about people and other animals, that you need, in order to have a relation, you need to have a distance as well. It sounds like that's what's going on there.
Yes, absolutely. It's a constant navigation between intimacy and respect for distance and alterity that's at play here. And of course, in that light, the monocrop form that is taking over native groves and forests takes on a whole different meaning, right? Because the monocrop is, the very logic of it is grounded in sort of domination and control and genetic modifications and simplified homogeneous reconfigurations of landscapes to produce profits, commodities, and so forth. So the plantation really is kind of the opposite extreme to that ethos of restrained care and respectful distance.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, it's always struck me, Marilyn Strathern's account of individuality and relationality in Melanesia has been very, very influential, especially to people who are not Melanesianists. And her portrayal of people as being sort of dissolved into the networks that compose them, I've always sort of felt it might lead people astray because it doesn't allow them to understand how important in many areas of this world it is for people to acknowledge difference and separation so that they can have a relationship. Strathern herself, I think, obviously understands this very well. But sometimes I feel that people who read her without having a lot of ethnographic background feel like human beings are dissolved into some sort of network or pool of relations with other people. Whereas I feel like you show very well the way in which the autonomy is a form of relationship or involves distance. And you mentioned these domesticates and the plantation. We should probably turn to discussion of the palm. And you talked about domestic kits earlier. You also talk about cassowaries, or a cassowary that was kept as a pet, and people didn't think it was cute. They felt sad for it because it could not run away in the forest and do cassowary stuff. Can you maybe tell me a little bit about that, and we can shift to discussion of the other side of this dichotomy of the two trees?
Sure, absolutely. The chapter that you're referring to focuses on the story of a juvenile cassowary that my companions named Reuben, and who they salvaged from a patch of forest that had recently been razed to make way for an oil palm plantation. And Reuben, the cassowary, was one of many animals that are now either being salvaged and brought back to the village by community members, or who are in fact themselves approaching marine settlements in search of shelter and subsistence as their own habitats give way to industrial monocrops. And what was really fascinating was the sort of really high degree of ambivalence that Marind expressed towards these animals, who they often referred to as orphans or as refugees. These were organisms that, much like Marind themselves, were losing their environments and homes to industrial plantations. And yet Marind were quite literally reluctant to pet them. They wanted to keep a distance from them. These animals were a source of anxiety and concern, and sometimes mockery, often sadness and compassion and pity. And in large part, arose from the fact that these animals were seen to be no longer free or wild or autonomous, because they were now confined or captive to the space of the village. They were also taking on all kinds of strangely human-like behaviors in the village, from eating rice and instant noodles to taking baths in plastic buckets. And that was, deeply strange to Marind, that these animals were becoming uncannily human-like and thereby losing their aptitudes and affordances as forest critters and as kin to other forest beings in their natural environments. And another big part of the ambivalence surrounding domesticates like Reuben was the impression that many Marind had that these animals, in fact, preferred to live in the village and no longer wanted to return to the wild. And often community members would try to coax these animals back to the forest. They would try to coax the crocodiles, the tree kangaroos, the deer, the cassowaries back to the wild. But these animals wanted to stay in the village. And so there were many questions being raised here about the intentionality of animals themselves. Is it that they want to stay in a human environment? Is it that they no longer want to return to the wild? And how does that then in turn perhaps speak to or mirror some of Marind's own conundrums over whether to maintain their traditional forest-based way of lives or whether to embrace capitalist projects like monocrops in the pursuit of a better or perhaps simply different future for themselves and their children and grandchildren. So these domesticates were troublesome or problematic, matter out of place, to borrow Mary Douglas's term, in many ways because they offered a sort of all too faithful reflection of the fates and futures of their own human keepers.
Yeah, so they really become an object for people to think through some of their own concerns about becoming domesticated and increasingly dependent on non-forest foods. And yeah, it sounds heavy.
It is, absolutely.
Sorry, that's not a question. That was just my comment. It sounds heavy. I don't know if that's a question or not, but yeah.
It is heavy, Alex. Many of the stories are, and the toughest part with this book was trying to tell the stories well and do justice to that heaviness through the theories and discourses of my Papuan friends themselves as sort of theorists of their own changing worlds. And just really quickly to go back to Reuben, this young cassowary disappeared one day from the village, and he was nowhere to be seen. And his disappearance only further intensified the sort of conundrums and conjectures among the Marind who had been keeping him. Some believe that finally he had returned to the wild and he had in fact not lost his capacity to live autonomously and in the freedom of the forest. Other villagers believe that he had been captured by plantation workers or military forces and eaten, or his body parts sold as tourist trinkets in Merauke City. And that, of course, that in turn raised all kinds of questions for Marind themselves. Was the disappearance of this bird pointing to a horizon of hope for Papuan themselves and potential emancipation from colonial and capitalist violence in the future, or were there darker fates awaiting them on those inchoate horizons of the future? And so the speculation surrounding this animal continued long after it itself had disappeared, who knows where.
And, you know, one of the other things that I found so remarkable about this book is that there are interludes between some of the chapters in which you describe what is apparently a very common phenomenon over there of people having dreams in which they are consumed or controlled or killed by oil palms, literally trees. So these dreams, like the cassowary, become these templates on which people project their own fears and anxieties. That's one of the most powerful parts of the book, I thought. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you came to include those dreams? And I'll give a spoiler for the readers, like the last dream is your own dream. So tell me a little bit about the process of putting that in and what role you wanted those to do in the book.
Sure. The chapters are interspersed with dream interludes, which are accounts of nightmares that have become increasingly prevalent amongst Marin communities following the arrival of oil palm. These are dreams that they refer to as being eaten by oil palm. And that idiom of consumption is widely used to describe the sorts of forms of violence that are associated with the arrival of this crop. Dreams of being eaten by oil palm, they're profoundly dysphoric, dystopic. People experience or witness their own deaths in the plantation over and over again, not just from their own human perspective, but also from the perspectives of plants and animals who are also threatened by the expansion of monocrops. Women's dreams of being eaten by oil palm involves experiencing tortured labors, deadly hemorrhages. In some of them, they birth these monstrously deformed oil palm fruit, or what they call oil palm children. Often people talk about having become lost in a plantation during these nightmares and having no reference point to situate themselves in either time or place. And so they're, you know, deeply horrifying, traumatic experiences that I was only made privy to quite late in my fieldwork. In fact, when I myself experienced one of these dreams of being eaten by oil palm, as I recount in the last interlude of the book. And that was a really diagnostic moment, because for Marind, it sort of marked the point where I had really truly come to a point where I understood the full force of what it means to live and die with the plantation form, both across the waking and the sleeping world. It was really hard to try to find a way to do justice to these often nebulous narratives where people were remembering often broken fragments of these nightly experiences. Many were punctured with long silences, protracted pauses. People would interrupt each other's narratives with fragments of their own dreams. There was a lot of weeping and sobbing and sighing, all of which, of course, are really difficult to communicate through the textual medium. How does one represent pregnant silences and pauses, for instance? Writing those dreams really sort of brought me face to face with some of the challenges of communicating oneric or dream narratives through the written medium. And at the same time, I think the narratives also serve a sort of stylistic purpose beyond their powerful substance, in the way they kind of break the narrative flow of the book itself. They puncture the sort of sense of cohesiveness and structure through these dispersed narratives that sort of don't begin and don't end, that sort of trail off into different directions. So the idea here is also to sort of push away from the cohesiveness of the story itself by bringing in dream experiences and their sort of nebulous narratives and really ghostly or spectral kind of significance in the marine life world.
I was struck by how much these dreams were about sago, or had sago as a primary material source for the dreams. So you speak in the book about the dream of pregnancy and oil palm, and you say that sago is often compared to women and women's bodies and pregnancy. There's another dream where someone is trying to harvest sago but finds that it's empty. So I kind of thought, although the dreams were obviously about oil palm, there was always this implicit moment of sago in them as well. And I just I feel like so many people who read this book are going to focus on one of the trees and not the others. But I felt like Sego was kind of there the whole time, even that dream sequence.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Sego was a recurring motif and figure across many of the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dreams that I was entrusted with during my time in the field. And yeah, I mean, in many ways, the Sego palm has come to embody for many Marind all that has been, all that is being lost and all that is being destroyed in the wake of the plantation. Often people would sort of, you know, move in their dreams across Sego groves and oil palm plantations, and the sort of Sego palm and the oil palm would at times merge. And at other times, you know, be very distinguishable. But there was a kind of a constant moving between these two palms and everything they come to embody as sort of two opposed ends of a, you know, political, moral, vegetal spectrum, if you wish. So yeah, both palms are equally important to the story, and both palms are best understood in relation to one another. And that was something that Marind always told me, that if I wanted to understand all palm, I had to understand Sego and vice versa. And importantly, I had to be in the presence of both palms, whether it was through walking to the forest to encounter Sego, or whether it was trespassing into a private oil palm plantation to be with oil palm, the being with mattered in both instances.
It would be easy to look at oil palm and paint it as the purely malevolent opposite of Sego, but you avoid turning it into a source of pure evil, and you describe to the reader the ambivalence and the multiplicity of emotions that people feel towards oil palm. Can you tell me about people's opinions of oil palm and the complexities of that? Not just that they hate it because it's taking over everything, but the fact that they see it as one tree amongst others, and they have lots of interesting thoughts and wonders about it. Is that right?
Absolutely, Alex. I mean, both the life worlds of Sego palms and oil palms are highly complex, but the ways in which Marind would, you know, talk about or theorize the world of this introduced invasive plant pointed to the fact that this plant did not exist as any singular thing or identity in the Marind worldview. On the contrary, it was a plant that was imbued with all kinds of conflicting meanings and speculations and affective affordances as well amongst the people who are just, you know, recently beginning to learn how to live with this particular plant. So in the book, I talk about the ways in which Marind, you know, fear, loathe, and resent this colonizing, you know, killer palm, which is taking over their lands and forests at the detriment of both Marind and their other than human kin. But I also describe how those discourses sit alongside other kinds of stories, stories in which Marind express deep-seated pity, empathy, and even compassion towards oil palm, because they see it as being itself very much subject to the violence of human and technological genetic manipulations in its transformation from plant to part to product and eventually to commodity. So there was a lot of pity and compassion expressed towards a plant that is also itself a subject of capitalist violence, as much as it is also a driver of violence amongst the peoples and places where it is being introduced. And alongside the pity and the compassion was also a widespread sense of curiosity about this new introduced foreign plant being with whom Marind do not share relations of kinship, whom they very much see as alien, but whose own life way, you know, they were also deeply interested in, you know, where it comes from, what it wants, why it is so destructive, and whether it is so destructive in the places where it grows, where it is native to. And people were very curious to know how it had traveled from West Africa all the way to Papuan lands, all the countries and places that it would travel through, both as a plant and then as a commodity, and these sort of multi-sided circuits across space and time. And so curiosity, speculation, fear, and compassion sort of all created a plant one that was really, you know, understood by Marine Desert through a series of ands rather than either ors, victim and driver of destruction, foreign colonist and near kin. And that sort of heterogeneity, that plurality is what I try to communicate in the book through this idea of dispersed ontologies, right? All palm is a plant that has a global career as plant as and capital, but it's also a plant that exists in multiple, often conflicted sort of ways within the worldviews of indigenous peoples who are learning to make do in its often violent company.
And could you tell me a little bit more about the extent to which Marin people see oil palm as an active agent in colonization? Because I got the sense that they, although they obviously recognized that Indonesians were doing things, they felt that the plant itself had a kind of agency in terms of the way that it colonized West Papua.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of the people that I worked with, you know, understood oil palm as a sort of botanical ally to Torque, Alfred Crosby's term, of the settler colonial project, in the sense that it was seen to be taking over lands and forests at the detriment of indigenous and native beings. It's a plant that's closely tied to government and corporate rhetorics of development, progress, poverty alleviation, all of which are part of a broader sort of civilizational mission that is routinely part of Indonesian state discourse when it comes to regions like West Papua. And so, yes, the agency of the plant was very much part of the story. And in that sense, there was a continuity with the way in which Marin understand their own native plant and animal kin, right? As agentive, sentient, animate beings who pursue their own sorts of life course and agendas. So that was, you know, being transposed to this introduced plant. But of course, as you rightly say, Marin are also acutely aware of the human institutional, economic, and political forces that are driving the expansion of oil palm in the particular form that it has been cultivated in West Papua, that is to say, in the monocrop form. And they know that oil palm doesn't have to grow in a monocrop system. It certainly doesn't in many parts of West Africa where it grows endemically. So people would constantly be, again, thinking through agency as something that's dispersed across plant, human and other kinds of actors, and never reducible to any one particular species or agent. Now, that was something that came up also in the course of the advocacy, right? Where often, you know, in the context of advocacy with state and corporate actors, Marind were having to engage in a kind of sort of strategic essentialism and avoid invoking the agency of oil palm and other non-human beings because it would often backfire. This was the culturally modulated way in which they understood agency as a multi-species phenomenon. But in the context of their advocacy, it often backfired in the sense that government and corporate actors would interpret these philosophies as evidence of primitivism, of animism, of superstition, that then only further reinforced their perceived need to modernize or develop or bring Papuans into the world of modernity and progress through inter alia and the introduction of industrial monocrop regimes. And so the contexts in which Marind were engaging with different audiences, states, corporations, anthropologists, very much in turn inflected the ways in which they would represent and communicate the agencies that are part of the story of what's happening on their lands and territories.
Perhaps that's one of the things that your book can do as an academic book that is still relevant to this kind of policy and anti-colonial struggle. You can provide the background that will help NGOs and others understand what Marin people mean when they say sago is, or excuse me, oil palm is eating us. Maybe this will be a way to help bridge that gap instead of forcing Marin to be legible in a way that might not be true to their own histories and cultures and traditions.
I very much hope so, Alex. It was, you know, I really do hope that the book, you know, can be addressed to anthropologists and academics, but also to broader audiences, including activists and NGOs, because I think it does that work of trying to push against the sort of nature, culture, or social and environmental justice divide by pointing to the ways in which the loss of the forest for Marind is a transformation that leaves no space or sphere or species of life untouched. And, you know, the centrality of Sago to the story is a major way in which the book tries to demonstrate how the loss of Sago in turn affects a sense of identity and belonging and being and becoming of Marind themselves as human beings. So the book tries to bring out that granularity, that messiness, how it can be then translated into effective advocacy, I think is a big and important question. But it's a beginning. It's a beginning towards telling the story in ways that do justice to that complexity, and that sort of stays with the trouble of the messiness of human and more than human entanglements on a plantation frontier, and a story that brings into the fold plants themselves as potentially consequential actors, not just as crops and commodities, but as actual participants in the making and unmaking of these, unevenly shared multi-species worlds.
Yes, I mean, ultimately, I think just airdropping thousands of copies of your book over oil palm plantations will not suddenly solve the problem. But, you know, these scholarly books offer a sort of anchor for future textual work, where you can produce work that refers back to it, and it provides a way in to a process in which the academic book ultimately plays a part, I think. I don't want to drag this interview on for too much longer, but, you know, since we've talked about the activist side of this, it strikes me that this book is relatively teachable, given the fact that it is an academic book, and I feel that it is a book that I could teach in my sophomore, junior level Pacific Islands culture class. Although I'd have to work with some of my students on some of the concepts. But you mentioned this concept of dispersed ontology earlier. And I know that we've been talking mostly about the ethnography, but I don't want to let you go without giving you a chance to talk a little bit about how this book speaks to wider debates in anthropology and how you think it could contribute to them. You've done a good job of describing the framework that you use and how it works and how you've used it to talk about Marind. But how do you see this playing into some of the broader discourses, and how do you think it might affect future scholarly discourse?
Thanks for returning to that concept of dispersed ontology, Alex. This is a concept that I developed really in conversation, of course, with the theories and discourses and experiences of my Marind interlocutors, but also with scholarship in environmental anthropology, in the ontological turn, and in the interdisciplinary space of multi-species studies and consonant currents, such as the environmental humanities and post-humanism. And the idea or the work, the conceptual work that this notion is trying to do is to invite us to think about, in this case, particularly vegetal beings through their multi-sided, multi-scalar and multi-temporal trajectories and movements. And here I was thinking in particular with oil palm. I suppose harking back to our earlier conversation about Marind's heterogeneous understandings of oil palm, the concept I think can travel well or can be transposed in terms of sort of moving away from static or homogenizing or reified understandings of ontology or realities by pointing to their to the mix of forms of fusion and fission and fragmentation and disagreement and disputes that all together participate in shaping the meaning and the maturing of other than human beings that we co-become with in more or less violent or harmonious ways. And in that sense, the notion of dispersed ontology for me can I think, do some useful work in rethinking violence, which is another central theme of the book, and particularly in rethinking violence as a multi-species phenomenon, right? One in which humans are not always the drivers and non-humans are not always the perpetrators. So I guess the idea is to sort of distribute the way we understand these practices or these agencies or these affordances. And in doing so, also, engage or contribute to ontological, anthropological scholarship that is both trying to take seriously the worlds and realities of the peoples whose life worlds they are seeking to understand and research, and by the same token, taking seriously the fact that many people disagree amongst themselves about what reality is, whose realities count, which worlds matter, and who gets to count in what worlds. And that's a central question to Marind as they're trying to grapple with this predicament of living with introduced plants and other sort of cellular formations, that idea of what it means to live well with other beings and what it means to share worlds with beings who inhabit very, very different worlds and worlds that are often unevenly distributed at the same time as they're often permeable rather than bounded.
You know, I realize now when I asked that question, I sort of framed it as a dichotomy between theory and ethnography, and perhaps that's just a very Gen X thing of me to do. Is your book in some sense trying to get past that binary? You say that so much of your framework grew out of your experience with Marin people. Is this a binary that's worth keeping, or is it been replaced already and I didn't notice? Or, you know, can you speak to maybe some of the blurring and dispersion maybe that's happening in anthropological theory right now? Is it crazy? Is that binary is a useful one, or does it obscure more than it shows?
I think it's a great question, Alex, and it's one that, to be honest with you, I still struggle with. I mean, there are times when I don't really, I think I don't understand exactly what theory is and what theory does. It's an important question, and it's all the more important, I think, in the light of the current climate in anthropology, where there is a growing call to decolonize the field, both in terms of its practice and in terms of its knowledge production, a call stemming primarily from indigenous and critical race scholars to sort of recalibrate our understanding of the relationship between method and ethnography and theory. And so the book really sort of tries to engage with those important ethical and political and intellectual conversations, including in conversation with indigenous scholars from the Pacific region, whose work has been deeply influential to my own thinking. So I think what the book is trying to do is to, as I write, avoid imposing on Marin's stories and experiences a sort of carapace of Western canonical theory, and instead move towards a sort of practice of weaving, which is one that I was instilled in by my Marin friends in the field, who weave sago bags out of sago filaments and fronds. And by this, I mean weaving ethnography with theory and also dispersing theory across knowledge being produced in the global north, and then theory produced by indigenous peoples themselves as theorists and ontologists of their own changing worlds, including through their own concepts, idioms, for the sort of changes and transformations that are happening across their worlds, changes that are not just theorized but also lived as philosophies and practices and as protocols. So yeah, I would say the book is trying to move away from the sort of framing of theory of something as something produced primarily by and for the global north based on realities that happen in the global south. It's trying to center Papuan people's own theories of change, and in doing so, attend to the really important things that they have to say about what it means to live and to make do under entrenched regimes of race and of capital. These are people who have something vital to contribute to our understandings of interspecies entanglements and violence in a broader age of planetary unmaking, and that we're all, complicit or affected with in one way or another, albeit obviously at different scales. So I suppose that's part of the decolonial project that this book is trying to engage with, whilst, of course, recognizing the limits of what the book can do within the entrenched architectures of colonial logics that continue to haunt both separate colonized places like West Papua and also institutional architectures like the university and academia. But it's a step in that direction, I suppose.
Yes, I think that no one, when they write a single book, should be responsible for completely finishing all of decolonization or theory or ethnography, whatever those three things might mean. But I do think overall, though, I was very struck by the book. I thought it was an excellent book. I would encourage people to pick it up. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but since we've been talking about some of these broader issues, can you tell me a little bit about what projects you might be working on in the future?
Sure, Alex. So I'm beginning to branch out in a number of different directions at the moment. One of my new research projects is focused on the question of multi-species justice. And this is a project I'm co-leading with Evan Kirksey and a whole range of collaborators, academics, but also activists and artists. And together we're trying to think through ways of decolonizing this idea or practice of justice from the law and trying to rethink other than human beings as potential subjects of justice, plants, animals, but also ecosystems and spirits and ancestors and so forth. So this question of justice is one that I'm trying to think with at the moment. I'm also branching out to do some ethnographic fieldwork here in Australia, where I've been living and working for the last 7 years, focusing on interspecies relations between humans and kangaroos, an iconic Australian species that is both a cherished form of wildlife and also a problematic pest. So there I'm going to try to, again, entangle questions of multi-species justice in the context of a emblematic but also problematic species. And finally, I'm still working through a lot of the ethnographic material that I collected during my time in Papua to try to put together a second book, which was going to be focused on cultural constructions of hunger and satiety among Marind peoples. Food insecurity has been one of the major impacts of the loss of forest ecosystems and the expansion of monocrops. So that second book is primarily drawing from Marind women's perspectives and stories to understand what it means to eat well and to feed well in a more than human world, and what we can learn from indigenous philosophies of food and diet and nutrition to rethink broader questions of nourishment in this age of planetary unmaking.
Well, those sound like really interesting projects, and I look forward to seeing what comes from them and reading your publications in the future. I think we are coming up on time, so I think I will let you go. But Sophie Chow, author of In the Shadow of the Palms, More Than Human Becomings in West Papua, thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for being in conversation, Alex. It was wonderful.
So this has been an episode of the New Books Network. Please go ahead and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to find more New Books content. And until next time, take care.